Originally hailing from Romania, our guest today did her undergrad in computer engineering and computer science at Cornell University before launching her career as a software engineer for the likes of Siemens Medical Solutions. After that time at Siemens, she returned to school, this time at Stanford, to get her master's in management science and engineering and her MBA. From that base of engineering, Mata Segede pivoted into consulting, business development, and product management for the likes of Deloitte and Yola.com, before venturing out on her own to co-found Kindred Prints. These days, Mata is the co-founder and head of marketing at Branch, a company powering mobile deep linking for the likes of Pinterest, Slack, Ticketmaster, and Tinder. In addition to that, Mata is a regular public speaker on growth hacking and mobile, including via her own podcast, How I Grew This. Stay tuned as we hear how Mata Segede growth hacked her way from software engineering to co-founding a company that's raised over $50 million in venture capital.
You're listening to the Developmentor Podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show: to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Hey, Mata, great to have you on here. Thanks for joining me.
Great being here as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, and I appreciate you as a fellow podcaster. I was on your show. I forget what episode it was, but it did air maybe in the month of August, if I remember right.
Yep.
So thank you for returning the favor and agreeing to come on my show as well. I trust you are doing well.
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to be here, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, why don't we kick off here? You know, I mentioned you came from Romania, you went to Cornell. I would really love to hear how you got your start into tech and why you pursued it as an undergrad.
I mean, I grew up in Romania and during communism from a poor family, and you kind of don't have that many options. It's like, I think when you grow without a lot of, you know, financial security, you're parents usually have very strong opinions that you will either be an engineer or a doctor. So I think I started getting into math, and I was very good at math. So when I applied for undergrad, and I applied to a lot of schools, my mom read the newspaper article saying, you know, if you have good grades and I won a bunch of awards in math, you can actually apply to school and get a full scholarship, which I did. And I felt like if I applied to an engineering school and if I applied to say that I want to have a technical major, I would have a higher chance. I didn't quite understand that that's not actually how it works. And if you go to a liberal, you know, if you go to a school like Cornell, once you're in, it doesn't really matter what your major is. But I didn't really feel I had a choice. So while I feel my friends described me as a creative type, I never allow myself to explore that side of myself. So I went into the more technical side of things. So once I got to Cornell, I remember I was dating a guy and he said, you know, you shouldn't do electrical engineering because it's the hardest. And I was like, what? You think I can't do it? So I had this chip on my shoulder and I was like, I'm going to do it just to prove you that I can do it. And that's probably not the reason most people get into their major, but that's how I turned out into doing electrical engineering and then concentrating in computer architecture.
Oh, I love that. I mean, I think there's something to be said for funneling or channeling your energy when somebody tells you you can't do something. I had a similar story in high school. Somebody told me I couldn't do something, and that fueled a lot of my college experience in terms of getting the degree and all that kind of stuff. So I love that. It's fuel on the fire, as they say, but you got to be careful. Otherwise, it burns a little too much, right?
Yeah, exactly.
obviously that's a big move coming from Romania to Cornell. You get your degree, you're proving this boyfriend or ex-boyfriend, whatever he is at that point, you're proving him wrong. I'm curious then, how did you approach your career in those early years? You know, I think I mentioned in the lead-in, you went off into software engineering and kind of taking this traditional path out of college of getting, you know, that CS degree. How were you thinking about your career in those early years leaving Cornell?
I think the way people sometimes think of their careers is like, are they taking charge of their careers or are they just following things that are pushed their way? And I would say in my case, it felt like I was a leaf on the wind, right? Like the way I got my first job at Siemens, I ended up interning, and what I found as I was interning is that I actually like doing computer science and software development a lot more than I liked doing the hardware part. And I did not enjoy hardware description languages. And as cool as processor design sounded at the beginning, the only two options I really had to do processor design were AMD and Intel. And I didn't really feel that that was something that I wanted to do. So I started applying to a lot of software developer jobs, but I only had a minor in computer science, so I was not as good as other people who did a major. So I don't think I could get some of the more highly coveted CS jobs. So I ended up with a job at Siemens, where I really learned, you know, I learned how to be a software developer, but also how to manage a team. And Siemens, I ended up joining Siemens after they had done a major layoff. And that was interesting because it gave me a lot of opportunity. I ended up managing a team of 6 interns, and that was like my first job out of college. And together we built like an internal testing tool, and it taught me a lot about, you know, being a good engineer, but also it taught me that I don't enjoy being an engineer as much because I just sit in front of a screen and I enjoy talking to people. So from that on, I realized that I wanted to do a career shift into jobs that where I worked more with people. And I think at the time, product management seemed like probably the longer term career path for me because I felt I was technical and because I like would work with people more.
Was that your creative side coming forward more in this realization? I mean, so you've got this math background, but you also have this creative side, and it sounds like this people side to you too, where they just starting to emerge as you worked more with the interns and kind of were dealing with more of the people side of the equation?
I think as I started like doing, I think as we worked together on that project, I had to like do a lot of the planning, the thinking, the design. And I realized that I really enjoyed that. And it's funny. And I realized that I just can't code all day long, that I'm like an extrovert. Looking back at that time of my life, I think I actually quite enjoyed it. And, you know, whenever people ask me about what was my favorite job ever, it's actually not that, but it's the internship, the co-op that I did 3 months before that, where I was an engineer and I worked in this manufacturing plant. And it was all this like pretty old school guys working on the plant. And I was like their engineer, and I would go and like debug furnaces or build things to make the furnace work better. Build like a lot of stuff that saved them a ton of time by building software. But that was also, I would like work and build little projects, but I interact a lot with people. In some way, I think software development can be very creative and you can build really cool things. My job with Siemens wasn't as much that. That project I worked with the interns was one creative part. The other things where I was like doing testing and working on this big software. Medical software is really massive. It would take a month for us to go and do an implementation and get like a hospital to use our software, right? So working on a behemoth like that, I realized it was just not my thing. But I would say, while that was true, that's not why I made the next shift in my career. Again, like a leaf in the wind, my application for an H-1B got denied. So I needed to go back to school. And that's how I ended up at Stanford. And it wasn't because I decided that I needed to make a shift. I would have probably stayed as a software developer for longer. Probably not for my entire career, but definitely longer than I did.
Gotcha. Well, so that was actually one of my next questions, which is, so this is roughly 2006. You you pack up your bags and you head to Stanford. And I was going to ask what inspired you, but it's literally the practical side of you want to stay in the United States and you didn't get a green card, so you got to go back to school. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, when I started, I realized my green card didn't go through very fast. The quota ended. The lawyers at Siemens made a mistake with my application. They signed with a different ink or something crazy like that. And then they reapplied. But by the time the quota was over, so I realized I wasn't going to get the green card very early, maybe 2 months, a month and a half. And at the time, I don't think the team was ready to make a decision on me and investing in me. And I think by the time, once a few months passed and I think I proved my worth, they were actually going to send me to their office in India and reapply. So that could have also been a really cool experience for me. So after I got into business school, into not business school, it was engineering master's at the time, I had to really think, you know, do I want to stay and go to India? This could be a very cool experience. Or do I go to school? And I decided to go to school. I think my best friend was starting a PhD at Stanford, and it just felt like a new beginning for me. And I'm, you know, looking back, I'm happy I made that choice at the time.
Well, and so then maybe I can ask the second part of that question. You know, so I get the what inspired it or what forced it, I guess is probably a better phrase. But why management science? And then also why Stanford? I mean, there's the obvious thing, it's Stanford, but you know, for you in that moment, why Stanford, why management science? And then spend a little bit explaining for our listeners what exactly management science is.
It's basically like, in some ways, helping engineers become more like managers. And it's basically a master's for people with technical backgrounds to learn how to manage better and how to do project management, product management. I think a lot of people who come out of the program end up doing product management. It's a very flexible program, meaning that you can concentrate in whatever you want. You have some requirements, but there's so many classes you can take. Why that program? I mean, I applied. I thought that, you know, like I was technical. Like I never took a step back and thought, like, what do I want to do with my life? I think I had this like mentality of like, I think my one of my friends talk about different ways, different mentalities in life. And one can be a mentality of abundance. You think about the abundance and you don't really think that you have constraints in life and you do the best things that you can. And there's this mentality of scarcity. And I grew up in a very scarce environment where you do the thing that's most likely to help you succeed, not the thing that you want, and you don't actually have the ability to go after what you want. And I think when I went to Stanford and I studied MSNE, I didn't think about like, what would I want to do? I thought, what would I be good at? What would get me a good job? What's closest to what I've done in the past? That's why I decided to do MSNE. I will say that that's when doing MSNE was the first time in my life where I felt like that shifted. And I think I started taking all these classes as a design school, and I started working with startups. And I started to understand there was a world and people could build extraordinary things. So I had this professor at Stanford, and I remember we were walking. I was helping him. He was teaching this small class, part of the design school, and I had taken his first class, did really well. So then I was taking this was my third class with him, and I decided to concentrate in design school. Which was like weird. I made my own concentration. And so I was walking to his car one night and we were helping all these startups. I think we had a project with Mozilla and I was like, we were building all this stuff. And I remember telling him, I was like, wow, this is so fun. Like, I love all these people that start companies, but I don't think I have it in me to start my own company. I probably will go and work for someone. It's just so cool to see these people start companies. And he stopped and he put everything on the floor and he looked at me and he said, Mada, if you don't start a company, like, who do you think will? And, you know, that was a moment. That was a moment when I think like my world changed and I was like, I never thought that I could do something that I wanted. I always did the safe thing. And this idea of taking a shot and starting a company seemed completely impossible to me. And at that point in time, I was like, yeah, maybe I could start a company. And everything changed. Like, I think that's when my mentality started to shift.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because I do want to get to the founding stories behind these. But I'm curious then, because you have this moment with the professor, and then, you know, you graduate, you get your degree, and you go off to Deloitte, which is the opposite of a startup. So tell me, how were you approaching kind of, okay, I'm getting this degree?
This was far after I had signed my offer with Deloitte. Some people do it in 1 year, some people do it in two. I had a scholarship for all my undergrad, and I didn't have a scholarship for this. So I took like fairly significant loans. I spent all my savings from Siemens, plus my parents gave me a little bit, but like they don't have much. And then I took significant loans that my best friend had to co-sign because I wasn't a US citizen. So if anything happened to me, my best friend would like had to pay all these loans. So I did it in 1 year. And the interesting thing about that is when you start school, that's when like two weeks later, recruitment started. So I had gotten an offer with Deloitte probably 6 weeks after I started my master's, and I had signed it. So I did consider, after having the conversation, after realizing I want to start a company, I talked to a lot of people and I considered, first of all, Deloitte was also going to apply and had already started to apply for a visa for me, for an H-1B. And, you know, it was going to be a safe thing that allowed me to pay my loans back. And I decided that I was going to take the safe bet, do it for a while. And then, you know, the plan at the time was, I probably won't go and start a company after Deloitte, but I'll go and work for a startup to learn. And I talked to like some entrepreneurs and investors, and that's what I did. I stayed at Deloitte for, I think, a year, and then I broke my contract and paid the signing bonus and went and joined a tiny South African company where I stayed for 4 years. And I learned a lot, both in like, I mean, that company did some things that were great and some things that were terrible. And I learned so much from both. And my co-founder, Alex, similarly worked for a startup that also didn't do very well in the end. You know, if I think about the funding team, we would not be where we are if Alex and I hadn't had those experiences. I think they were, in a lot of ways, so important to who we became as founders ourselves.
Yeah, interesting. Did you move to South Africa as well?
No, it was a South African company that had an office here. But I did go to South Africa quite a lot. And also I learned a lot about how terrible it is to have a development team that's like half in one place and half another. And in the early days of Branch, we made the decision to not do that. We have a development team in Europe, but it's not like, you know, we don't have leaders in both places. Or I learned a lot as we built a global company. I think we, being in a company that had two offices that were always at odds, helped us understand a lot.
Yeah, I can relate to that. We wouldn't have multiple offices, but we were remote almost from the get-go. And I love remote for a lot of things, but it's hard when you're founding a company to be remote. I guess these days it, you know, it's probably more normalized, but back when I was starting Lucidworks or co-founding Lucidworks, it was just different. Hey, Developmentor fans, be sure to check out the new online series of conferences from Manning Publications called Live at Manning. As many of you know, Manning has been a longtime supporter of the show, offering up free books and discounts for our listeners. Now we're teaming up with them as a media sponsor to spread the word on this new conference series. These conferences are free to attend, filled with talks from some really great tech experts, and stream globally via Twitch. No travel needed. Next up in the Live at Manning series is a one-day event focused on math and data science. It is on December 1st, starting at 12 p.m. Eastern. This is your chance to hear from speakers like Brian Godse, Nicole Konigstein, An Lei, and many others. During this show, you'll be able to dive deep on math topics like principal component analysis, linear regression, and probabilistic modeling. Be sure to head over to developmentor.com/manningmath, all one word, to find out more. In case you didn't catch that, there's a link in our show notes. We'll see you there. I'm curious, you mentioned in there you learned some really key lessons while working at this startup. But, you know, reflect for a moment on one or two of those.
I mean, I think a lot of it is, you know, when you build a culture, you can't just like say things, you have to exemplify things. And at the end of the day, as a founder, you have to put your employees first. And the way to motivate a team to work hard is by working hard yourself. Also, I think one of the big lessons was really this idea of like, try to get profitability early. don't go after, you know, numbers, like crazy growth, have like actual, like real, like goals and bring real value to people.
Such novel ideas. And we just need more eyeballs.
I'm very involved in the brand shaping branches culture. And I think, you know, a lot of the books that I've read on culture recently talk about all these things. But
real quick, what's one or two books on culture that you really rate highly?
The Culture Code. What I like about The Culture Code, it really thinks about how groups can gel well together and what makes the group work well. And the other one is Ben Horowitz's new book, What You Do Is Who You Are, something like that. Thought that was very good. And then I'm reading now the Netflix book, No Rules Rules. My co-founder said, Alex was like, this is the most fundamental book ever written on business. Alex tends to exaggerate, but I do think it's very well written and it's making us think a lot about changes we want to make the organization.
If you don't define the culture or recognize that there is a culture, then the culture will define you. And it's almost always not a good experience. So, well, I would love to then, you know, so you go off to Deloitte, you're at Yola. I think maybe there was a little side trip to Buenos Aires in there or something, maybe, but.
Yeah, during business school, I did a month. I worked for a startup in Buenos Aires. It was fun, but I was working mostly on my own startup at the time. So,
yeah, I was going to say, so kind of bring me forward into this. You take the leap to start Kindred Prints. You're getting an MBA. I think all of these things are kind of happening right around the same time. Is that right? Tell me about what was going on then.
So, you know, I think I wanted to start, I knew I wanted to start a company when I left Stanford MSNE, and I think while I was at Yola, but I think I have this idea, like I worked somewhere and I built a lot of loyalty to the company and I get pretty bought in. And it's very hard to make that like jump. And I was kind of doing stuff on the side and realized that I wasn't very good at it. And then something dramatic happened. My green card got denied. So again, visa issues brought me back to school. But, you know, the company reapplied and I actually got my green card before going to business school. And I'm always going to be incredibly grateful for my manager and the CEO who, you know, although they knew by that time that I was applying to business school, they reapplied for the green card and I got it. I found my own lawyers, which was awesome. The lawyers they were using before were terrible. It was probably the worst experience I've ever had. They fucked up my application. But that's why I consider applying to business school. I didn't actually know that had I not gotten the green card again, I probably wouldn't have been able to go to business school. Because if you've shown intent to stay in a country, you can't get a student visa. But I didn't know that until I actually got in. And then I was trying to figure out what to do. And then my green card got approved, which was probably, I remember exactly where I was. I was traveling actually with my current co-founder and my boyfriend at the time and someone else. And we were in the middle of Thailand and in a car, and I got the notifications that my green card got approved. And, you know, in some ways that changed my life because they gave me so much freedom. And once that happened, I was like, well, if I go to business school, I'm not committed to a company. I can start my own company. And funny enough, I went there. Alex was always working. Alex, the co-founder that was in the car when I got the thing, we became friends. And he was working with some other people on projects all the time. And I was partying like people do in business school. And I remember coming back from parties and I seeing him in the MBA lounge coding and always having this feeling that like, man, what am I doing with my life? These guys are actually building something. So I asked him to coffee. He was telling me about his projects. One project was something link related. I was like, oh, this is not that fun. But then he was like, but this other thing I'm thinking of is this like a dog collar. And I was like, oh, yeah, I love dogs if you ever want to do that. And then the link thing, he started not really getting along with his co-founders because I think they were like, they all wanted to do the same thing. They all wanted to be the leader. It was just some issues there. And then I was like, why don't we apply to this class, which had the professor that convinced me to apply to become, you know, the Michael Deering guy. And we applied to his class together and kind of like got our other Arthur co-founder, Mike, to apply with us. And we got into that class. And that class teaches you, it forces you to like build a company. They give you like $1,000 credit to use a lawyer and incorporate. And they don't force you to do it, but we did it. And there's just a bunch of stuff. And at the end of it, it kind of felt like we had the company and we had to keep going. And we kept going with a very different idea. We ended up building the an app, Kindred Prince, and eventually we raised money and pivoted to Branch. But, you know, it all kind of like just happened. And I think we ended up, through all the ups and downs of building all these companies while in school, really, you know, what came out of that year and a half of failed companies and failed ideas was actually us as a team. We are extremely different people with very different strengths. And even now, new people coming to Branch don't understand how we're still together as founders and how we still get along, although we are like night and day difference. And that, but like what came together, like we was used to fight a lot in those early days. Now we never fight. We're like always on the same page. But the year and a half of struggle, I think, built us as a team. So when we started Branch, we just like flew. Like we didn't have any founder drama, any issues. We just executed.
Because you had already been through the founder drama. Is that right?
Exactly. We had been through the founder drama in the first, like, we had three failed ideas before Branch together.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, so this is the stuff that doesn't come forward on a resume, right? I saw Kindred Prince, and then there's these other things in there, like some of the investing you do and your Stanford instruction, you know, like the classes you teach. I did not realize that Branch came out of Kindred as a pivot. So tell me a little bit more. Like, tell me about some of these failed things and like how you, more importantly, like how you work through those failures as a personally and as a team.
Yeah, the first one was a Fitbit for Dogs, and we pivoted probably a week after we finished the class. I remember last day of the class, professors are like, rate 1 to 10 how likely you are to continue doing this. And I'm like 11, Mike's like 10, Alex is like 12. Then a week later, we wrote the professor's note saying, you know, we stopped doing this. So what happened was a competitor raised a lot of money and went launched something public. And it just kind of felt like it was a very crowded market, really, really low margins. You know, the competitor got bought, but, you know, like, I don't think even now the product's not profitable for the company that bought it. They bought it more for brand purposes.
Well, and dogs don't know how to count steps, so.
Right? I mean, yeah, we had a different approach. We wanted to make it more like a, it was also tracking where the dog is and then like tracking the level of anxiety if you left the dog home. But then, you know, a camera does a better job of that. But we were a very good team. You know, Alex had a lot of hardware experience. At Yola, I was a product manager and I knew how to do like front-end development, not well, but, you know, reasonably well. And I had some design experience. And then Mike had built like, he had a lot of patents for consumer products for like companies like 3M. So I think we were a good team to build a hardware consumer product. It turns out that that wasn't like very market and we really enjoyed doing that. So we ended up sitting in a room like MBA students do. We declined all our internships and we're like, let's use the summer between first and second year to do something. And during that summer, we came up with this idea of building a photo book printing app. And we were like, well, like we take all the photos on our phone and our parents and grandparents prefer printed stuff, but there's no easy way to print photos from your phone. Let's build an easy way to do that. So that's how the printing app came. And then the app itself, we realized, and I do talks about this, it's so hard to acquire users for your app. So we're like, what if we build a service that actually allows other apps to print? And that's how we launched a service and integrations with printers. And also, as we were doing that, we realized that the apps didn't care that much about monetizing. At the time, the most important thing that investors and everyone cared about was growth. How do you grow your app? And as we were trying to grow our own app, we realized that there was this big problem, this idea that like you don't know when someone's coming to the app. You can't share the content within the app. The app store is this wall that doesn't make a connection between someone inside the app, you know, content within the app and someone clicking on a link. And we felt that if we solved that, we could fuel a lot of the growth of the small apps and also large apps and give them better understanding, better attribution. And that's how Branch came to be. We, you know, we were starting to realize that printing won't be a really big business, that it was working, but not super well. So we ended up actually selling the printing business. We became too attached to it to shut it down. And, you know, a word of advice, probably we should have shut it down because transferring the company took so much effort instead of us focusing on Branch in the early days. And the company that bought it eventually did shut it down. We just couldn't. We were so attached to that business. We had been working on it day and night for a year. And I see this as a big issue with a lot of founders. You build a company and if you're successful, it's great, but a lot of them become so in love with their initial idea that they can't just shut it down and move on to something else.
Yeah, you gotta be able to kill your darlings. I know I went through that a lot and had some similar experiences, and we wasted actually a good few years trying to make something work that just was never going to work. So yeah, there's two founders sharing to all of our listeners, pay attention, right? You know, don't get attached.
And I think, you know, to be fully honest, the only reason we are where we are is because my co-founder Alex is very emotionally detached, and he was able to make that decision. But even he while he saw that this was not the future for our team, he said, but if we can't find anyone to buy it, my wife and I will just run it on the weekends. Like, even he got, like, he could see and make the, as a good CEO, he could see that, like, that's not what we should do. But his personal side still felt the attachment.
It is hard. I mean, there's no doubt there's so much truth in that. Explain just a little bit more. What is this deep linking concept for our listeners? And then I want to get back into some questions I have for you on your career, especially now that you're at Branch. But
yeah, I mean, the deep linking, it's this idea that if you think about the web started as this amazing democracy. Some people came together and came up with the HTTP standard, and you can put a website there and send someone a link to that website and to any page in the website. And as mobile emerged, mobile was not, you know, a free environment. Mobile was owned by these big platforms that their main goal is to make money and to keep people on their platform. So they did not come together and decide on a linking standard of how to take people inside apps. The Apple and Google have very different linking standards, and apps can be built in different ways. So if you want to actually send someone to a page within the app, to a place within the app, it's not that simple to do that. There are standards that help you do it if the user already has the app. But if the user doesn't have the app, that becomes more complicated, because someone would click on a link, then they go to the app store, then they open the app. And then you need to make a link between, a match between someone clicking on the link in the first place and now opening the app to take them to the intended place. And that's sometimes not easy. So we make link that work always. Like, I might share a link from an app on iOS and someone on a desktop might click on it. We enable you to do the link routing and make sure that regardless of where the person is and where they click on a link, they're taken to the right content, whether they have the app or not, whether they're on iOS, Android, if they click in the WeChat browser or the Facebook browser. You'd be surprised the limitations that the platforms put. And, you know, we feel it's our job to go around those limitations and make sure that a brand's users always go to the intended content when they click on a link.
That's interesting. Yeah, I had no idea. I know what deep linking was, asking the question, but I hadn't really thought about all the complexity of it. So thank you for sharing that, Mata.
It's a lot of edge cases. In a lot of companies build deep linking in-house, and it works for 70% of the cases, but the other 30% are usually the hard ones.
Well, and so coming back to you, you know, so you've got these other founders, you know, one of you referred to it as founder drama. One of the early founder dramas is usually who gets what role, you know, who's the big scary CEO boss, who's the CTO, who's sales, all of these things. You've landed, you know, you started off software engineering. We didn't really cover it, but for our listeners, Mata also spent some time in business development and product management. And now here at Branch, you're the head of marketing and market development. How did that happen, and what all's involved in that for you?
I mean, it wasn't an easy path. I would say that in the very early days, yes, I think when we were doing the dog thing, we considered me being the CEO. I think it was very obvious in our group that Alex is the emergent leader. He was the one pushing us forward. He was just, I think when you read about groups and how like leadership exhibits himself, he was definitely our leader. Like, it happened very early on and we all accepted that. And there wasn't really a struggle, because it was just so obvious that he was the leader. I don't know how to explain it. And to this day, I think that's continued to be true. I think for my role specifically in the very early days, Alex, and I remember we were in a room and deciding to do Branch, and Alex saying, well, I really think that this is going to be a really you know, very technical business and we don't really need business people. But like, if you and Mike want to stay around and do cold calls, like, we definitely need that. And I remember thinking of like, man, will these people like use me? While I was technical, I wasn't as technical. Like, this branch is a heavy, heavy technical product. And if we're doing the Fitbit for Dogs or the app, actually, since a lot of my experience was in front end, you need more of that. But with Branch, I mean, I did do, like, I designed the original dashboard. I built our original website from scratch. And I did do some of that, but that didn't seem to be as, that wasn't as important as it would have been for a more consumer type product. So I didn't feel I was technical enough to be a product manager. And also, we didn't need a product manager. Alex was the product manager because he also did the coding. And it was more like, okay, well, I need to be on the business side if I want to stay with these guys. And I think the decision to stay with them was like, these are, out of all my jobs so far, I've never worked with people who I felt was smarter than me and pushed me to grow. And I decided to stay with the team. And it was really interesting that I was like, well, I'll do whatever needs to be done. And in the early days, that meant, you know, building the website and the dashboard. But like, it was very obvious that, like, while Mike and I both did sales, he's very organized and he's very much like, he was taking care of all the business side. So he went more into operations role and COO, and I was more the creative side. I was building our blog and coming up with campaigns and building the brand and all of that, building our logo and all of that. So that felt more like Alex was like, okay, we raised the seed. We all need titles and roles. Otherwise, investors might come and push one of us out. It seems like marketing should be your thing. I was like, yeah, I actually really like marketing. That's how it happened. Like, very weird and randomly, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I don't think I've ever been happier in a role than I am in marketing. I started really loving it. And I realized that this was like, when I was in consulting, I remember always wanting to be on marketing consulting projects. And they always took me on like the digital transformation and the heavy tech stuff because they didn't think I had marketing experience. And when I went to business school, I was thinking of going to like Kellogg because I want to study marketing. So I always had this like interest for marketing. And then when I started doing it, I was like, this is amazing. This is marketing is exactly, you work with people. You need to be very like numbers driven and good at math. And you need to be somewhat technical and you need to be creative. And I was like, this is like exactly the three things that I need in a job and they're in one. And I can, like, you know, if I think of like my role on the team, I mean, I lead the team, but my individual contributor role is I come up with very creative campaigns and I test them. And then I find others who turn them into processes. But I can also dig into numbers and figure out why things are the way they are. And I think that makes me probably a good marketer and a good marketing leader.
Don't you love when all of these things that have been a part of your life come together?
I mean, it's funny because I always thought I wanted to be a product manager. And I was when I was at Yole. I went to product manager management. And I actually realized that I hated it. And I was terrible at it. And not because, you know, I was technical enough. I just, you know, being a product manager requires you to be organized. And you just have to deal with the details all the time. And I realized that, like, that's not me. I like thinking big picture. I like coming up with creative ideas. But marketing was never as like sexy as product management or as engineering. I think in some way, when you think about organizations, marketing is like more like a lower level position. But I actually found that the other two leaders on my team both have very technical backgrounds. And I think the best marketers today are people who are actually very technical and smart and creative.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and, you know, and especially you're selling to technical people, right? So you've got to be able to talk their language. It's funny, Mana, like how much, you know, we finally got marketing right at this point in my LucidWorks journey. I don't know if right's the right word, but we got it a lot better. And it was finally having somebody in the role who really kind of got all the things that you just described. They could do the creative, but they could also crunch the numbers on whether it was working or not, right? Whereas perhaps older in the past, more traditional marketing wasn't so much about crunching the numbers because there was no numbers to crunch, right? It was just assumed it worked, right? Whereas the web changed all that, so... No, I love that. I'm curious then, you know, what has it been like for you as a founder in terms of your own personal growth and the growth of your career? I mean, I think you hinted at some of these, but kind of bring these together for me, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I never like really imagined myself to be a head of marketing, and I still don't know if I'm the right head of marketing as Branch grows. I think I'm good at the side, and I've struggled. You know, I've like left marketing and look for other people because I wasn't sure I had enough experience. So a lot of it was very challenging to learn on the job. I came in and I had done marketing for the apps that we built, but I actually feel like consumer marketing is very different than SaaS marketing, and I didn't know some of the systems. I was too scared and insecure to hire leaders that had more experience than me. So I think I made a lot of mistakes, and I think I learned from them. I don't know what the future, you know, holds, but I think for me, I do know that if I left Branch tomorrow, I would probably either start a small business, probably not a big business, that was more on the creative side where marketing played a big role. I have some ideas, or I would go and like lead marketing for a small company. And in some ways, like I would not go and try to do something else. Like I feel like I found my career and what I love doing in life. And I feel very proud of what I've achieved. I think when I was a kid, I never imagined where I would end up. I think my dream was to be a bank teller at one of those new banks that were coming up after communism fell in Romania. And to me, like that was like the most I could ever achieve. There was a point in my life, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, maybe three, I don't know, where I was like, I made it. And what I mean by I made it, I don't mean like I'm rich or anything. It's just more like I have achieved so much more than I ever thought I would, that I stopped having the chip on the shoulder. And it was very freeing. So now I feel like I let go of my marketing role and I felt fine with it. And then I got it. I went back into it because the company needed me to do it. I felt like my whole life, I had this like thing that I needed to prove myself in every job. And now I like don't quite have it. And I do it because I love it. And because like I want the others to get the most out of it. It's been a very like freeing thing. So I don't like have this like, oh, I have this vision for my career. I don't actually like whatever I do next, I'll be okay with. I feel like I've already reached way above I could have ever dreamed of for my career, if that makes sense.
I'm speechless. It makes a ton of sense. And I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, it's, you're hitting me at a lot of the things I've always felt too. I think, well, I didn't grow up under communism, but it, you know, grew up like wanting to prove myself, right? And I think that's a lot of what goes into building people's careers. And like you said, sometimes it leads to you making decisions that solely are about the title or the role or the paycheck and are not in balance with your values. And I'm not one of those that believes you must follow your passion, but I do think you need to find a way to align your work with your values for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I wouldn't say that deep linking was my passion, but building a company with a strong culture is my passion. Working in a company that has a mission to make the mobile ecosystem better. I think the way you put it is much better, right? Like figuring out what your values are and finding a job that aligns with them. If you are in a job that doesn't align with your values, and I have been in jobs like that, it can be incredibly miserable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like you said, there's times in life where you just need the damn paycheck, right? And you got to do what you got to do as long as it's not criminal, I would say. But yeah, if you can find and work towards it, and it sounds like you've done that a lot of ways. I'm curious, you picking up on a little thread there, you're passionate about building companies with strong cultures. What do you see as like maybe, you know, Mata's one or two or three founding principles of strong culture?
I was talking about some of the books that I've read, and I think this idea that like, if you have a culture where people know what's expected of them when you're not looking and they actually do it and they know what it takes to be successful, I think I would say that that's a strong culture when you like, you know, I did this exercise at the beginning of, I think it was like a year ago when I was kind of taking a sabbatical from my VP marketing role. And I asked 70 people at Branch what they felt was expected of the high performers at Branch. And I did like a word cloud. And we actually ended up changing our values based on that because we felt like what people said was more in line with what we actually expected of them than what we set our values to be. And it wasn't like a huge shift. Most of the values, like for example, in the past, we had one of our values was execution. And we realized that, like, we actually didn't just expect people to execute. We expected them to execute, but like with impact and prioritization. So we changed execution to impact, and we added like good judgment as a value, and we made some small changes like that. I think this idea that like everyone on the company kind of knows what's expected of them. Everyone on the company agrees that these are the important characteristics, and everyone can, when you ask them, you know, what do you love about this company, they kind of say the same things. That's part of a strong culture. But a big part of it is actually like, one, communication, and two, enforcing what you want the culture to be. And you know, there's so many ways to enforce culture, from onboarding to the way you hire, to the way you fire people, to the way you do compensation, to the way you do promotions, to the way you do events, to the way you communicate. When we did the whole culture investigation, like I came up with like 7 areas of the business where we needed to like continue enforcing our values and our culture if we wanted to continue scaling with a strong culture.
Mata, bringing it on home here, you know, you've given such terrific advice. I usually ask about career advice and mentorship, but I think you've covered so many great things in here. So just one final question for you, which is, where can our listeners best connect with you, whether that's LinkedIn or Branch or Twitter or your podcast?
LinkedIn is a good one. I'm very active on LinkedIn. Probably that's like my most active social network. And you can find me if you look up Mada Branch, my last name. Mada299 is usually my like screen name for everything. My mom picked it up for when she created my ICQ when I was going to college. I didn't want to create one. So then I just used it my whole career. And it's like, I'm bad on Twitter and on Instagram and everywhere. And then I have this podcast that I interviewed you on. So, you know, the opposite of this conversation, called How I Grew This, that you can find pretty much. It's on all the platforms.
Yeah. Tell our listeners real quick, what did they learn on How I Grew This?
I'm trying to look at like people in growth and what does growth take. And, you know, growth in organization spans between product, marketing, engineering, analytics. So I bring people, leaders from all those different areas and from like really cool companies. And I ask them both about what they did to grow, to drive growth in their current companies, but also how they grew personally. And it's just like conversations like this one, but maybe a little bit more for like, I think I would say that probably half of my podcast is really tactics and things that people have tried in the past and what's important in actually driving growth in an organization.
Yeah, it's a fantastic. I really enjoyed my time with you on that as well. So I would encourage our listeners to check that out. We will be sure to link up all of these things in the show notes, as always. Mata, fantastic to have you come reciprocate with me. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are 3 ways you can help out. 1, make a donation via Patreon. 2, if you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3, buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.